Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. First of all, I have to welcome Venerable Shifu back to the monastery and express my great pleasure at seeing his face so radiant and so youthful. Even from the moment I walked in, it looked like he lost 5-10 years by his trip to Taiwan. Okay, now we have been studying we started to study the Sutta Nipata, and we began with the Ratana Sutta. This is called the Jewels Discourse. This is a sutta which is based upon the qualities of the three jewels, the Sun Biao, and it uses the recitation of the qualities of the sun of the three jewels as a kind of blessing. It draws upon the anubhava, that is the blessing power of the three jewels, for the purpose of warding off danger and bestowing safety and good fortune. And according, as I explained last time, according to the traditional account, the Buddha spoke this sutta on the occasion when Vasali had been afflicted by three misfortunes: the misfortune of a plague, misfortune of famine, misfortune of attack by malicious spirits, evil spirits. And so he recited the sutta to the Venerable Ananda. Venerable Ananda walked around the city reciting the sutta and sprinkling water, and by doing so, all of the misfortunes of Vasali were dispelled. And as a result, this sutta is used within the Theravada Buddhist tradition as a way of blessing any newly commenced activity. For example, when a company opens a new building, they'll invite monks to recite the sutta. When a new Buddha school is opened, monks will be invited to recite the sutta. When somebody starts a new career, they will recite the sutta. So it has, or is believed to have, a blessing power. But apart from that, it very skillfully brings together in very nice, beautiful verses all of the essential qualities of the three jewels according to early Buddhist teachings. And last time we went through the verse number 3, which is a very concise invocation of the spiritual power of the Buddha jewel. Now we come to the Dhamma jewel. And I will recite first in Pali, then translate, and then give explanation. Kayang viragam amatang panitang yada jagasakyamuni samahito natena damena samati kinchi idam pidame ratanang panitang etena sachena suvati hotu. Okay, usually when we speak about the Dhamma, we think the Dhamma means the Buddha's teachings, the teachings that we have in books and in lectures. But when we speak about the Dhamma as a jewel, or the Dhamma as a refuge, the question comes up, what is it that is really the jewel of the Dhamma? What is the real Dhamma that is the refuge? And in the early Buddhist teachings, it is said that the true Dhamma jewel the true Dhamma refuge is twofold. First, it is that ultimate aim of the entire practice of the Dhamma, that is the unconditioned element, the unconditioned reality, Nibbana, the deathless element. And then, in a secondary sense, it is the world-transcending path, the supermundane path that brings the realization of the deathless Nibbana. And so the two verses in the Ratana Sutta that praise the Dhamma jewel do so by praising first Nibbana as the Dhamma jewel, and then the supermundane path, the world-transcending path, as the Dhamma jewel. And so first we take the verse that praises the Nibbana as the Dhamma jewel. And I would have translated this verse, number 4, somewhat differently from the translator of the book. He has, the sage of the Shakyans of a tranquil mind realize that cessation which is passionless, immortal, and excellent. I wouldn't have given any privileged status to one of these terms, but just in the Pali, all four of them are lined up one after another. Kayang, viragang, amatang, panitang. So these are four ways of describing Nibbana. First, Nibbana is called kayang, which means destruction. This is usually taken to be a negative quality. But it's destruction of what? It's the destruction of craving, this thirst that drives us through the beginningless round of samsara, exposing ourselves to many types of suffering. So in many suttas we have Nibbana explained as tanha kayang, destruction of craving. Elsewhere, Nibbana is explained as the destruction of greed, hatred, and delusion. So when Nibbana is called destruction, or here in the book, cessation, that's what is meant. This would be mie jin in Chinese, mie jin. Then the next one is dispassion. This would be wu yu. Is that correct? Wu yu. That's absence of lust, absence of passion, or the fading away of passion. Yu de tun. Would that be correct? Tun. I saw in C.C. Chuang, he uses tun, fading out. Tui, is it? Tun, that's it. Tun. Yeah. So it's the fading away of passion, of lust, of desire. Okay, so these two seem like negative terms. So this makes early Buddhism sometimes seem negative. This emphasis on destruction of this, fading out of that. But the next two terms show the positive side. Nibbana is amatang. And in Pali or Sanskrit, amritang. So it's a negative, well, it's also a negative, but it's such a beautiful term. It suggests the idea of deathlessness. Not that one goes on living as Bhikkhu Bodhi forever without dying, or Chi Lao She forever without dying. But it's a state of complete freedom from birth, aging, and death. Maybe this would be Wu Si, non-death. Is that Wu Si? And then the last one is panitan. This is, we translate it, excellent. I think in Chinese this would be miao, or miao jila, would that make sense? Miao de Buddha liao. Because it's like the most excellent. So something which is supreme, which is the goodness, is so good that it's considered inexhaustible. And then it said that this element, this reality, Nibbana, is something which is always existing. It doesn't come into being, it doesn't pass away. And at the time of the Buddha, all of the sages, the renunciants, the seekers, the wanderers, were all seeking the state of deathlessness, the state of excellent state of liberation. But the one who found it, who discovered it, was the Buddha, the awakened one, the one that was called Sakyamuni. The word Sakyamuni actually is not a proper name, but it's a title, an honorific title, which means the sage of the Sakyans. And so it said, Yad Ajaga Sakyamuni Samahito. He discovered it Samahito, in a state of samadhi, a state of concentration. And then the verse continues, there is nothing equal to that state. There exists nothing equal to that state. Natena dhammena samatti kinchi. And in this statement, that little one line is expanded upon a sutta that comes in the Anguttara Nikaya, which says that to whatever extent there are things, dhammas, phenomena, that are conditioned or unconditioned, sankata va asankata va, dispassion is declared the best among them. That is, then has a long list of synonyms, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. And so when one recites this, one first recites these qualities of Nibbana as this most excellent state, then one says, Idampi dame ratanang panitang, this is the precious jewel in the Dhamma, or this precious jewel is in the Dhamma. By this truth may there be safety. One is now attuning one's mind to the precious spiritual power of the Dhamma, and making one's mind a channel for that spiritual power, drawing that spiritual power through one's mind. And if one is reciting through one's voice, and then bestowing safety and blessings upon others or upon oneself. And since the Triple Gem is the most worthy, the most exalted, the most powerful source of blessings in the whole universe, then if one has confidence, trust in the Triple Gem, little by little one makes one's mind, one's body, one's voice a channel for that blessing power of the Triple Gem. Okay, the next verse, verse 5, refers to the path as the Dhamma jewel. Again, I will recite the verse in Pali and then explain the meaning.
Yam Buddha Seto Parivanai Suching Samadhimanantarikanyamahu samadhinatena samo na vichati idam pidame ratanang panitang etena sachena savati hotu.
I have a fault of being very picky. And so when I see something in the translation that I'm not completely happy with, then I have to retranslate to myself. I started doing that 30 years ago, 32 years ago. And as a result, I had to retranslate the whole Samyutta Nikaya. Okay, it says, the Supreme Buddha prays that purity, and here comes a technical term which they call Yambuddha Seto Pari Vane Suching Samadhi. Okay. The Supreme Buddha prays that purity which they call the concentration with immediate results. It's literally, it's the concentration without any interval. Then the printed, the book version in the book, it says there is nothing equal to that meditation. Atena dhamme. My version says there exists no equal to that concentration. Yeah, my version is better, because his version says there is nothing equal to that meditation. But that is not the case, because that meditation, that concentration, is not the equal of Nibbana. Nibbana is the ultimate jewel, the ultimate refuge. And that meditation is of value only because it leads to Nibbana. But there is no concentration equal to that concentration. This is considered the supreme concentration. Okay, and this is the precious jewel in the Dhamma. By this truth, may there be safety. Okay, so now what is being referred to here first is the concentration of the Noble Eightfold Path. In that same sutta that I quoted, which calls Nibbana the supreme Dhamma, the text goes on to say that of all conditioned phenomena, of all conditioned states, the best of them is the Noble Eightfold Path. Then in the Dhammapada, it is said of all paths, the Eightfold Path is best. And so here we have under the Dhamma jewel, the Noble Eightfold Path is brought in. But the Eightfold Path is brought in under a special heading. It's brought in under the heading of Samma Samadhi, right concentration. And not simply ordinary right concentration, but this is the concentration of the world-transcending or supramundane Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, now what is this supramundane Noble Eightfold Path? First, one begins by cultivating, developing the ordinary, we call it the mundane, ordinary Eightfold Path. One develops right view, one has right intentions, one practices right speech, right action, right livelihood. All of those form the basis. On that basis, one develops, one applies right effort to developing the four foundations of mindfulness. Through developing the right four foundations of mindfulness, one will be developing mundane right concentration. that right concentration might reach the level of jhana, absorption. Maybe it won't reach the level of jhana. At a certain point, one uses the right mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness, to develop, based on that concentration, to develop insight. Insight goes deeper and deeper into the understanding of the nature of things, the nature of one's own experience, the nature of the body, nature of feelings, nature of perceptions, nature of various mental volitional factors, the nature of consciousness. And when that probing insight reaches the very rock bottom, then it rises up from all conditioned phenomena and touches, sees, experiences, realizes the unconditioned. This is the wisdom that makes the breakthrough. Abhisamaya panya. Xian guan. And that experience of the breakthrough to the unconditioned element is a state of samadhi. It occurs at the level of a jhana. The mind is fixed in concentration, but in that concentration, the most active element is prajna, wisdom, which is now penetrating the ultimate truth. And with that active penetration, certain defilements are cut off permanently. And when one emerges from that concentration, one becomes a noble person, no longer Ibanren, an ordinary person, but now one is Shangren, a superior person, a noble one. And that concentration, that is the concentration spoken of here, is concentration with immediate results, because it brings its fruit, its benefit, immediately after itself. As soon as that penetration takes place of the ultimate truth, immediately the defilements, certain defilements are cut off, and one emerges as a noble person of one of the different levels. I'll come to the levels in a few moments. And this concentration, the text says, tatena samadhina tena samo na vijati. There is no concentration equal to that concentration. So that concentration is praised above all other concentrations, all other samadhis, because all other samadhis, their benefits are transient. Even one gains any of the ordinary jhanas, one masters them, one can be reborn in many of the higher realms, the Brahma worlds. One could live there for hundreds, even thousands of aeons. They say if you get into the formless, if you master the formless attainments, wu se, ding, was it wu se, sanding, samadhi, chanting, yeah, wu se, yeah. Yeah. Sitting. Yeah. Se wu se ding. Yeah, right. Even if one masters them, one is reborn in the formless worlds, no body, everything is peaceful, quiet, equanimous, undisturbed, imperturbable, for thousands and thousands of aeons. But then, maybe after 20,000 aeons, 40,000 aeons, 60,000 aeons, the alarm clock goes off. or somebody comes around and says, even though you have no body, but they hit you over the formless shoulder and says, come on, get up, get up. Your time is over. Time to go down. They're waiting for you down there. Then you fall down from the formless realm to some other realm and have to start all over again. Going through the hospital, coming out the mother's womb, having to get fed again, having to go to the toilet, having to work at a job, go to school, having to register to vote, having to be faced with choice of politicians, all over again, again and again. But with this concentration, one goes step by step to ultimate liberation. Okay, so this is verse 5 on the Dhamma jewel as the path. Now the next few verses, we come to the third jewel, the Sangha jewel. Again, I will recite.
Yei pugala atta satang pasatta chatari etani yugani humti te dakineya sugatasa savaka ete sudinani mahapalani Idampi sangye ratanang panitang etena sachena suvati hotu.
Okay, now when one speaks about sangha, normally one thinks of Sangha as the monastic order. And in a conventional sense, we say that the Sangha is the monastic order. But the actual Sangha jewel, Sangha refuge, is not the monastic order, but something else which the monastic order merely represents. The jewel that the monastic order represents is the Aryan Sangha. This is the community of noble ones. The word Sangha means literally it's grouped together. So community. And this is the community of noble ones. And to become a member of the community of noble ones, there's no formal ritual or rite of ordination, but it's a matter of spiritual attainment. And those who belong to the Aryan Sangha fall into 8 categories. They're made up of 8 classes. These are called the 8 classes of the noble disciples. There are actually 4 grades, 4 main grades of noble disciples. And those 4 main grades become 8 because each of the main grades has 2 phases. One is a phase of path, a phase of fruit. I'll explain that in a moment. Okay, the 4 main grades. The first one is called a stream enterer, sotapanna. The stream enterer is one who has reached the first level of realization, who has made the first breakthrough to the truth of the Dhamma. By doing so, the stream enterer has broken permanently. Well, if I explain that, then I'll be getting ahead of myself. Doesn't matter if I repeat when I come to the later verse. Okay, the stream enterer has broken permanently 3 fetters. Fetter of personality, of identity view or self view, the fetter of doubt about the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and the fetter of attachment to rules and rituals, rules and observances. I'll explain these later in connection with another verse, a later verse. And the stream enterer is bound to come at most 7 more times to the world before making a complete end of suffering. If one practices further, then one comes to the next stage of enlightenment. This is the stage of once returner. The once returner doesn't break any more fetters, but significantly reduces greed, hatred, and ignorance. And the once returner comes back to this world one more time. If one practices further and makes the next breakthrough, then one becomes a non-returner. The non-returner doesn't come back to this world any more times, or never comes back to this world, but takes rebirth in one of the pure abodes, one of the pure realms reserved for non-returners, and there reaches the final goal. The non-returner eliminates completely sensual desire and ill will. So he no longer has any ties binding to the sensual realm. Then if one completely eliminates the 5 higher fetters, desire for form realm, for existence in the form realm, desire for existence in the formless realm, conceit, restlessness, and finally, ignorance, then one reaches the 4th stage of realization, the stage of arahat. Then one has no more rebirth in any realm. Then one is completely liberated. Now, each of these main stages has two phases or 2 grades. One is the stage of path, where one is reached a certain level such that one is bound to reach the fruit. One is bound to make that final breakthrough in that same lifetime. Then there's the stage where one makes that breakthrough and one reaches the corresponding fruit. So we have a person practicing for the fruit of stream entry and a stream enterer. Somebody who is practicing for the fruit of once returner and the once returner, somebody practicing for the fruit of non-returner and the non-returner, somebody practicing the path to arhatship and the arhat. Those are the 8 persons. And those form 4 pairs. And these are called the worthy disciples of the fortunate one. Te dakineya sugatasa savaka. These are the worthy disciples of the sugata. Sugata is a term for the Buddha. I think it's shansha in Chinese. It means literally well gone, which doesn't really mean very much in English. So I use a very free translation, fortunate one, it could even be taken as blessed one who has reached the state of good fortune. And these who has followed his instructions, followed his guidance, and reached some stage of approximation towards the goal by following his guidance, those are called his savakas. And I have to say make some comments about this term. In Chinese, it's translated shangwan, correct? Sound hearer, which is an attempt at an etymological translation, which doesn't really capture the meaning at all. The correct translation in contemporary Chinese would be dizi, dizi, meaning a disciple. And when one looks at early Buddhism from the perspective of later Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, sometimes you think that in the Buddha's community of followers, there was a group of Shravakas, group of Pratyeka Buddhas, group of Bodhisattvas, and you think these are different classes of the Buddha's followers. But actually the word Savaka simply, that didn't mean a specific group of the Buddha's followers. It simply meant disciple. It was used in all of the spiritual communities in India at that time. Everyone had a teacher. The teacher was called the Satta, the master, the teacher with a capital T. And the teacher would attract a group of followers that he would instruct. Those followers who listened to his teachings, accepted his teachings and practiced them, were called his savakas. So Mahavira, the founder of Jainism, contemporary with the Buddha, he had his savakas. They were not that he had a group of Buddhist followers called savakas or shravakas. Makkali Gosala had his disciples. They were Makkali Gosala's savakas. Some others. Purana Kasapa had his followers. They were called Purana's savakas. Each one had his followers called savakas. And so in the Buddha's community, also all of the Buddha's followers who really took his guidance to heart were called savakas, or sometimes called Arya savakas, in the sense of being disciples of the Noble One. The Buddha is the Aryan, the Noble One. But then there were certain disciples who, by following the Buddha's guidance, reached the levels of realization of attainment. They became Arya Pugalas, Noble Ones, people of attainment, who had reached stages of realization leading to the goal towards which the Buddha was pointing them, the goal that the Buddha himself had realized. And now these disciples are said to be te dakine ya sugatasa savaka e te su dinani mahapalani. What is given to them, whatever is offered to them, yields abundant fruit. This is an idea rooted in the spirituality of India from the Buddha's time, continues even today, probably, I would say, not probably, definitely, in the communities, the village communities, rural communities of India. The idea that it's worthy to make offering to ascetics, to those who lead a spiritual life. I say definitely, because I had this experience myself going alms rounds in India as a Buddhist monk, just with a sign. Somebody wrote a sign for me in one of the Indian languages in the region where I was, and I would just go to the village with the sign. When I come, everybody runs away. But I just stand there with the sign, and a little boy will come out, because most of them are illiterate, but a little boy who might be going to school, he'll come up quite hesitantly, take the sign, read it. He'll recognize this is a sadhu, a sannyasi. He'll go back into the house, tell the people, and within 5 minutes, they're all coming out with bowls of food to make offerings. Because it's just, it's imprinted into their consciousness from 3,000, 4,000 years ago. The idea that one should make offerings to sadhus, renunciants, religious ascetics. But the big question on the people's minds was, to whom does offering, to whom do offerings yield abundant fruit? This is using the metaphor of sowing crops as an image for the working of karma and its ripening. Because this is people living in a rural economy where every year they're growing 2-3 crops of rice, wheat, or other grains. And so the image is that of sowing seeds. The seeds grow and bring the harvest, the crops, rice, wheat, fruits, vegetables. And so the image is you make offerings to religious ascetics, and by doing so, you acquire merit. And that merit will in time bring benefit to oneself. It's not that they're greedy to be wealthy or to have power, but to secure the blessings of material security, to have good living conditions, and for those who have faith in the Dhamma, to meet the right conditions for practicing the Dhamma. Extremely important. As a Buddhist follower, one doesn't want to take rebirth in a country in the Middle East or sub-Saharan Africa. Of course, even there you can meet the Dhamma. We had just a few weeks ago a Buddhist monk from Uganda here. So it's possible even in these remote areas today to meet the Dhamma. But in the Buddha's time, it would have been if you took rebirth in one of these regions, very difficult. Just in recent times, 40 years ago, taking rebirth in North America, almost impossible to meet the Dhamma. 40 years ago was 1964. It was possible, but quite difficult. Okay, so here in this verse, the Buddha takes all eight noble persons, the path attainers, the fruit attainers, as representing the Sangha jewel. And these are called the worthy disciples of the fortunate one, and the offerings to them yield abundant fruit. Because they have reached the planes of true, the stages of true holiness, true spiritual realization. So when one makes offerings to them, those offerings yield abundant fruit. And so in reciting the verses, one thinks of the noble Sangha, all of the eight persons, all of the great disciples going back to the Buddha, draws upon their spiritual power, and one uses one's mind, one's voice as a channel for conveying the blessing power of the Sangha, blessings upon others, blessings for oneself. In verse 8, the Buddha singles out now from the Sangha jewel, from the eight persons, he takes the highest attainers, the arahants, and takes them as representing the Sangha jewel. Again, I recite.
Yesu payuta manasa delhena nikamino gotama sasanam hi te pati patta amatang vigaya lada mudani puting bun Jamana Idampi Sange Ratanang Panitang Etena Sachena Suwati Hotu.
Okay, first this verse speaks about the arhats by way of their past practice, the practice that led them to the stage of arhatship, that yesupayuta, that they've exerted themselves well, supayuta manasa delhena, with a steadfast mind in Gotama's teaching. Gotama is the name of the Buddha. Sometimes the texts speak about him by his personal name. And so they've become nikamino, desireless. And they've attained that which should be attained, and having plunged into the deathless, they enjoy the peace obtained without price. So first, the verse emphasizes the importance of effort, that it's through right effort that one realizes the goal, and that effort is applied to the development of the mind, and one has to maintain a steadfast mind, a firm mind, a vigorous mind in following the path. And when one applying the path to the Buddha's teaching, and when one applies the mind in this way, then one attains that which should be attained, what should be achieved, what should be realized. And when one reaches the higher stage, then it uses the expression plunging into the deathless. The deathless is pictured here almost as though it were like a pool of cool water. Of course, India, even North India, is often, it's a hot country, hot region. And so the idea of liberation, of bliss, is that of coolness, plunging into a cool pool, cool pond of water. And the deathless is pictured as a cool pond. And then one enjoys this peace, nibbuting, that's nirvana, obtained mudang, without any price. Like people spend a lot of money to go on holidays. You go to Europe for 2 weeks, go to see Thailand or China, go to Mexico, spend a lot of money, come back, and you're exhausted from the trip. You feel, after that vacation, I need another vacation. But this is the peace obtained without price. You don't have to pay any money for it. All you have to do is exert oneself well with a steady mind. And that special peace here, this is what is called, it's referring to an attainment accessible only to the arahants, to the Buddha, to the arahants. It is not Nirodha Samapatti, it's not Shoshang Mia. It's not the cessation of perception and feeling. Is that understandable? Shoshang Mia. Again? Mia Shoshang Ding. Yeah. It's not that. That is a different attainment. But this is called, in Pali, Arahata Pala Samapatti. The attainment, meditative attainment of the fruit of arhatship. This is an attainment. It's a samadhi that the arhats can enter, in which they dwell experiencing the state of nirvana. There is still perception in that state, still feeling in that state, still consciousness. But it is the feeling, perception, consciousness are all immersed within the nibbana element. Maybe I'll try to get one more verse in. Maybe I'll just speak a little bit on the side about another related topic. There is a tendency sometimes amongst Buddhists of different followings to oppose arhats and bodhisattvas and to see which one is superior to which. And then this leads to conflict, friction between followers of the different vehicles. Followers of Mahayana say bodhisattvas are superior to arhats. Arhats are narrow, selfish, small-minded. Followers of the Theravada say followers of the bodhisattva vehicle are deluded or taking too much time following an impossible course, something too difficult, that one should just aim quickly for one's own liberation. And so this leads to certain conflicts, quarrels, friction. The way I see it, both sides, followers of both paths, have to respect each other. First of all, if there were no bodhisattvas, there could be no Buddhas, because Buddhas arise from bodhisattvas. Every Buddha is the end product of one who has followed the bodhisattva course. But also, if there were no arhats, there could be no Buddhas. Because what is the task of a Buddha? A Buddha is one who aspires to achieve Buddhahood in order to liberate many, many sentient beings. And those beings who are liberated by the Buddha are liberated by attaining arhatship. If nobody followed the Buddha's instructions and attained arhatship, then the Buddha could not be a Buddha. He would just be teaching pointlessly. Because the Buddha, the function of a Buddha is to discover the path to liberation, the path to Nibbana, and to teach it to the world so that many other beings could follow that path and realize the same state of Nibbana, the deathless element that the Buddha himself realized. And those people who follow that path and realize the deathless, those are the arhats. In fact, the Buddha himself is arhat. When we recite the praise to the Buddha, we say Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. And in the qualities of the Buddha, Iti Piso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho. So the Buddha, first of all, is an arhat. An arhat is one who has realized liberation. The arhats are also, in a sense, Buddha, in that they reach sambodhi. They reach full enlightenment, not with all the powers of knowledge, with all the skill and teaching that a Buddha has, but they reach the same essential knowledge of enlightenment that a Buddha has. They are liberated in the same way that a Buddha is liberated. And the arhats carry on. They don't just seek their own liberation, but the arhats, through the centuries, from the time of the Buddha's great arhat disciples, Sariputta, Moggallana, Ananda, even Mahakachayana, many others who are hardly known, but they carried on the task of teaching many, many others, and then after the Buddha's passing away, rehearsed the teaching, formulated it, preserved it for many, many generations. Okay, and so I think for Buddhism to thrive successfully, there has to be mutual respect and mutual understanding between followers of these two paths. Otherwise, Buddhism just splits into two, and it can't thrive, flourish successfully. Maybe I should stop at this point and then pick up and continue next week. Or actually, in 2 weeks. Shall we take a little break? I don't know how we should handle. I think so, yeah. Yeah, Shoshi. Okay, we'll stand up. And then, yeah, I'll do the dedication of the merit. Okay. Then we'll just stand up, stretch a little bit. Then if people have questions, we could deal with questions. Just for about 15, 20 minutes. Okay, we do the sharing of these merits with the devas, nagas, buddhas, other beings, asking them to rejoice in the merits, to protect the Buddha's teachings, to protect the exposition of the teachings, to protect ourselves and others, then ask them to rejoice in the merits and to achieve all success. Especially we have to ask them to protect the world at this very critical time, very critical point of time. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.